From the Lives and Opinions of Eminent Philosophers by Diogenes Laertius, translated by R.D. Hicks. Anaxagoras, the son of Hegesibylus, or Eubulus, was a native of Clazomenia. He was the pupil of Anaximenes, and was the first to set mind above matter. For at the beginning of his treatise, which is composed in attractive and dignified language, he says, "All things were together, then came mind, and set them in order." This earned for Anaxagoras himself the nickname of nous, or mind. And Timon in his Silly says of him, "Then I ween there is Anaxagoras, a doughty champion whom they call mind, because forsooth his was the mind which suddenly woke up and fitted closely together all that had formerly been in a medley of confusion." He was eminent for wealth and noble birth, and furthermore for magnanimity, in that he gave up his patrimony to his relations. For when they accused him of neglecting it, he replied, "Why then do not you look after it?" And at last he went into retirement and engaged in physical investigation without troubling himself about public affairs. When someone inquired, "Have you no concern in your native land?" "Gently," he replied, "I am greatly concerned with my fatherland," and pointed to the sky.
Where is my mind? Where is my mind? Where is my mind? Way out in the water, see it swimming.
Anaxagoras, Room 3SSB, Green Hall, University of Chicago, 1968. When I was hired to an associate professorship in the English department in 1961, she was already a distinguished tenured professor of the Department of Psychology at the University of Chicago. I met her. Quite literally bumped into her, as goes the expression, at the Reynolds Club on the Quadrangle on just the second day of my first semester in harness, when I stepped from a food line with my tray and spilled it all on the floor. It is a toss-up to blame my clumsiness or her diffused attention. She seemed the proverbially absent-minded professor, and should have been the natural butt of that hackneyed joke, except that one presupposes it should allude to a splurge-haired, needle-nosed, spectacled don of Oxford, a dusty reader of Restoration poetry, such as myself, indeed, rather than this short, impish-looking, middle-aged female scientist, who was otherwise renowned for her laser-sharp insight and keenly exacting research. She should be, if her person resembled her professional reputation, a tall, astringent man who kept fastidious notes of every daily observation and habitually carried a stopwatch to discipline school clocks for accuracy. Rather, she seemed loosely organized, misplaced her papers, lost her way to class sometimes, sometimes distractedly stopped in the hall and turned about for something she had forgot, because she always worked overmuch. So preoccupied intellectually, she often talked earnestly to herself as she walked from her office to her lab at Green Hall, or in her customary trek to the faculty club, and is also reputed to have talked to herself as she walked the four or so blocks from the university to her home, situated on Bixler Park and the play lot, and was sometimes seen to talk to herself as she sat by herself on the L when she went downtown to the Palmer House for high tea on Sundays, the sight of which should have invited comparisons to certain homeless types who also often appeared to sit talking to themselves on these same trains. The difference between them being their odor, they smelling of urine and she of lavender, and their dress, she a proper gentlewoman wearing her usual understated wool tweed suits, which she obtained on her annual treks to Burberry in London, while they a heap of ragged, filthy layers. And yet, as I saw, if she is present to speak, if present to mind, she is as keen as a kid in a kitchen with cake. Ah, such eager eyes, like an elf's, merry and bright, and nothing ever missed by her insight or her heart. She was not married. She lived alone in her townhouse. She had never had a lover, so far as I know. She had a cat, fat, somnolent cat, whom she called Bugger. She unintentionally killed any living houseplant she ever had given to her, and she never bought them for herself, although in her backyard she had a splendid, cloistered English garden, by which I mean an unkempt, crowded, eclectic plethora of flora, partially shaded, which nature took care to water more often than she. She always ate out, or brought takeout food home, which she shared with the cat. After a few glasses of Cabernet, she was wont to play her upright piano in her parlor, and sing from sheet music for her cat, singing Irish ballads or American show tunes. In the summers, on her way to boat over to London in Burberry, she visited Broadway in New York City, and once in her homeland, she took the shows at Piccadilly. She was an aficionado of musical theater on both sides of the pond. She was short and small, and had a delicate, sweet, round, childish face, like a 19th-century porcelain doll of German craft, with a natural rose to her high, shiny, fresh-washed cheeks, and a naturally rosy, pretty mouth. And if she saw you, if she was alerted to you, she smiled at you and greeted you as though you were the one person she wanted to see in all the world. And when you left her, she always said she was sorry that you had to go, and she meant it sincerely. A more gentle and naturally happy person I have never met. But, as I say, sometimes as ditzy as a bimbo, she could be oblivious to real life, and stumble into trees as she read books while walking, or should give her cat a bowl of Cabernet in lieu of milk, or may bump into a junior professor who carries an overloaded lunch tray and cause him to spill it all on her tweeds and his chinos and befoul the high-glossed, pristine linoleum floor of the venerable, solemn food halls of the university club. She was so kind to me on that occasion, assuming blame more sincerely than simple courtesy should require, helped me to clean my pants with her handkerchief moistened from the water fountain, and insisted upon buying me my lunch, which, abashed as I felt, my humiliated appetite shrank to a bowl of humble soup. I did not in all this even learn her name, because she seemed completely engrossed in me. My journey to the portals of these celebrated sacred temples of literary learning, and I, self-important as I was in those days, enjoyed talking about myself. Who does not, I suppose? But it was her manner of addressing you that promoted this, more than my own egocentrism. She was always otherly directed, if I may put it thus. She had indeed not even told me her name, and I had neglected to ask it. I discovered her name in the manner of the fabled TV Western as it ends when the masked man disappears in the repeated rite of its oft-wrote plot. Who was that woman? I asked a frowsy student in beads, tie-dye, and afro shrubbery, cleaning the tables. Oh, she replied, that is Dr. Casey. Would I be her Kemosabe? Dr. Edith Casey was born in Belfast, Ireland, on November 26, 1920. Her parents were both primary school teachers, who together authored a series of guidebooks to Irish sites of lore, Hallows of the Tuatha de Danann, which became known as the Casey Mystic Guides. She was educated first in the Convent of Daughters of Jesus in Belfast, and later at the Star of the Sea Primary School for Girls, a state school. In a confidential note I later found in one of her journals during our investigations, in which I was to play an unfortunate role, she compared her institutional education to her intimate domestic education and stated her preference for the parental, peculiarly eccentric though it was, over that which she received from a stifling, though rigorous, matriculation at state schools. She won a senior open scholarship to Somerville College, Oxford, at age 17. In 1940, she was awarded a Bachelor of Literature degree from Oxford University's Faculty of Litera Humanoris for a thesis on certain states of consciousness. In 1946, Casey was awarded a Doctorate of Philosophy degree by the Oxford Faculty of Litera Humanoris for a thesis on aspects of perceptual consciousness and the mind-body problem. In 1948, on holiday travel to America, delivering an academic paper based upon her doctoral thesis to a forum at Harvard University, she sought out John B. Watson in his home at Whippoorwill Farm in Westport, Connecticut. She found him drunk on horseback. She told him that she wished to discuss with him his uses of GSR, that is, galvanic skin response measurement, in human experiments, having heard that he had applied these to monitor and test the sexual responses of a young female lab assistant. The experiments were duly recorded in minute detail and annotated subjectively. It is said there was a great deal of data. Unfortunately for Watson's career and marriage, the records were inadvertently discovered by his wife, who happened to be the daughter of the Secretary of State to President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and he was compelled to accept a harsh divorce, to resign his academic position at Johns Hopkins University and abandon his work at its prestigious laboratory. And thereafter was only able to find employment for his expertise in behavioral psychology in the American enterprise of mass advertisement. Dr. Casey's interest in his experiments was not prurient, though Watson seemed to have hoped for so much. But rather, she told him, she hoped to further her own research initiatives with objective indicators of perceptual consciousness, specifically that GSR might provide benchmark data for brain activity during dreaming and other states of consciousness which are considered not normal or actual. GSR measurement is one component applied in polygraphic instruments and is used in legitimate scientific research of emotional arousal. However, it has a provenance of charlatanism and goofy ideas. and had been employed by C.G. Jung in his investigation of subconscious responses to words in 1906. In 1936, Wilhelm Reich studied GSR in his experiments at the Psychological Institute of the University of Oslo to confirm the existence of an alleged bioelectric charge around his concept of, quote, vegetative pleasurable streamings, close quote. The E-meter, which is used by the Church of Scientology, is in fact just such a GSR measurement device. A person whose GSR measurements shows relative non-conductivity during questioning concerning the stresses of one's personal self is said to be a clear in accordance with the church dogma. Her own application of GSR is one of the many unscientific aspects of Dr. Casey's research, which began to concern her colleagues and professional peers, but it was not really for this that she had visited Watson. She had been fascinated by the objective of his studies. She shared that objective, his quest to map the mind of man, to find the routes of motivation and the locus of will. His sexual experiments had been an exotic side trip to the more important mapping that he had made. It was rather the strange, though long ago well-received and academically published reports of another of his experiments that had concerned her, had arrested her attention in the months just previous to her visit to America. Even though a very old publication, it had fresh context that disturbed her profoundly. In 1920, the year Edith was born, in fact, Watson had conducted behavioral experiments on a 9-month-old baby named Albert. Albert's mother was a wet nurse at the Harriet Lane Home for Invalid Children, affiliated somehow with the university's health clinic. Watson and the aforementioned young female lab assistant, while currently assiduously engaged in their own ongoing private experiments with GSR, having chanced to have met the young mother, proposed to her to experiment upon Albert for a substantial stipend. Watson's applications of the GSR upon little Albert also intended to measure emotional response. First, baseline data was compiled. Wired to GSR, the infant was exposed to a white rat, a rabbit, a dog, a monkey, masks with and without hair, cotton wool, burning newspapers, and so on. Little Albert showed no fear toward any of these items. Approximately 2 months later, when he was just 11 months old, Watson began to apply conditioning to these encounters. For example, placing Albert on a mattress on a table in the middle of the room, a white laboratory rat was placed near Albert, and he was allowed to play with it. As play continued, Albert, unafraid, even enjoying the rat, was then startled by Watson striking a suspended steel bar with a hammer whenever the baby touched it. Not surprisingly, little Albert cried and showed fear as he heard the noise. After several such pairing of the two stimuli, Albert was again presented with only the rat. Now he became very distressed as the rat appeared in the room. He cried, turned away from the rat, and tried to escape it. Unfortunately, little Albert seemed to generalize his response so that when Watson sent a non-white rabbit into the room 17 days after the original experiment, Albert also became distressed. He showed similar reactions when presented with a furry dog, a seal skin coat, and even when Watson appeared in front of him wearing a Santa Claus mask with white cotton balls as his beard. Although Albert did not fear everything with hair, "What happened to Albert?" she asked Dr. Watson. "I do not know," she was told by him. He was taken away before I could finish my experiments. He said that was very annoying and made him angry at the time and had resulted in data not as complete as he'd wished it to be. She said she left him at the farm, feeling a nauseated contempt and loathing for him, for his experiments, and for his ideas. At that time, in the aftermath of the late war, lurid magazine exposés then illustrated with graphic images the iconic horrors of the Nazi death camps and Hiroshima. And the whole world had learned that there had been state-sponsored sinister science to the method of murder, an industrial efficiency, an ironic, frightening intellectual abstraction towards suffering, applied by designers and managers who evaluated effects of methods utterly objectively, solely to improve that inflicted suffering, that the methods should be more horrible. Confronting Watson, she hoped to challenge the moral conscience of him and to assure herself that it must be the misguided, fiendish scientific positivism of overwrought thinking, a holy quest maddened by zeals such as his, in which must lay responsibility for civilized cruelty and the institutional madness of war. It must not be, she hoped, that it lay in the true heart, in the very of nature of man, that such cruelty abides. She would refuse to believe this was so. She felt, however, listening to him, a desire in her own self to murder him, to inflict upon him such suffering as the child felt. And this human emotion, she realized with despair, condemned mankind. So she departed in shock and returned despondently to England. Watson, for his part, was flattered by her visit and had found her attractive and decided to help her further her research. In the perversion of the fates, his shame brought him fortune. While ostracized from academe for almost 2 decades, his effectiveness with advertisement was enormously successful and personally lucrative. And the application of his behaviorist psychological theories to mass marketing had resulted in his renewed acclaim and its popular interest in his ideas. The U.S. military overtly adopted his learning theories in their training practices. Industrial psychologists extolled the practical application of them. Pedagogical theory for public education was reformed wholesale by it. Moreover, having long-standing cachet with the University of Chicago, where he had obtained his Ph.D. and had conducted his original celebrated experiments with white rats, and to which he had fondly donated several large, generous endowments, he persuaded the Department of Psychology to cable the young Irish doctor of philosophy and offer her a position. It was a complete surprise to her. She had not asked for it, but the economy of Great Britain after the war was in shambles, and she had no other prospects. Though having never seen Chicago, she accepted the position and arrived before the quads, bemused and excited, with the cliché carpetbag in her dainty hand on a crisp gold and scarlet-leafed fall morning in 1951.